abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Tuesday, December 3rd, 2013, and we are joined today by the great Will Grigg by popular demand. And when I say by popular demand, I don't mean to suggest that you guys had to twist my arm to get Will Grigg on here. I'm thrilled to have Will Grigg on here. I've been wanting to get him onto the program, and we were able to make it work, so I'm very glad to be able to welcome him in a few minutes. I do want to make a couple of announcements about the program this week. I don't know for sure what the schedule will be, but I do know what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to have a couple programs this week that'll be just me talking. I hope you can endure that. But one of those is going to be about the Pope, Pope Francis, and his comments on capitalism. And I realize I'm a little late getting to this, but I'm insanely busy making hundreds of homeschool videos for RonPaulHomeschool.com, and that's pretty time-consuming, and it drains me, and I'm exhausted all the time. So I'm fine, you know, better late than never, right? Plus, I did write a book more or less on this. My book, The Church and the Market, pretty much covers anything any of these people are ever going to say. So you can always console yourselves with a copy of The Church and the Market. So I'm going to do that this week. I'm also going to do a little podcast on what I told the law students about secession. I was invited to St. Louis University School of Law last month, and the topic they gave me, I didn't foist this on them, they gave me the topic of secession, the constitutionality and legitimacy of secession. So I gave them a full talk on this. It was an academic talk, but I'm going to give you the executive summary of that talk in a podcast this week. And I don't know which, I've got some bunch of chats I'm having this week with people. Robert Higgs, Bob Higgs, one of the great economic historians of our time. We'll be talking to him. Lots of great stuff coming up, but I don't know which day is which. It all depends on when do I get around to finally reading what the Pope wrote. I haven't done it yet, haven't had time. Maybe I'll do it at lunch today. I don't know. But that's roughly what we're going to be doing this week. And once again, thank you guys for helping out the program, helping us keep this little office that I have to record these programs by, at no cost to you, entering Amazon at TomWoodsRadio.com. When you're about to make your purchases from Amazon, just enter Amazon from our little Amazon widget at TomWoodsRadio.com, and at no cost to you, you can help us pay those bills. All right, right now, I'm very glad to welcome Will Grigg. Will Grigg is a former senior editor of The New American Magazine. He is the author of several books, including Liberty in Eclipse, The Rise of the Homeland Security State. You can follow his Pro Libertate blog at freedominourtime.blogspot.com, and you can also follow him at prolibertate.us. I strongly urge these upon you. We'll put these links up in the show notes for this program at tomwoodsradio.com. Will Grigg, thanks for taking some time with us today. It's a real pleasure to have you here.
Dr. Woods, it's a pleasure and an honor to be with you. I have long read your work with admiration and gratitude, so I consider this to be a real privilege.
Well, likewise. In fact, I think we met at a talk you gave in New York City when I was still in grad school years ago. So I guess in saying that, I'm saying you're older than I am. I didn't mean it that way, but anyway.
Older than you are.
I think this is actually the first time we've actually been able to sit down and actually have a conversation, so I'm really glad about that. And you've become a real authority on this subject. I mean, you had written on many different topics in the past, but now you're sort of like the police state, law enforcement abuse kind of go-to guy that everybody knows. In fact, people have been asking me repeatedly, when are you going to have Will Grigg on your program? So today is their lucky day for sure. So I want to start off more generally and then get into some specific cases of items you've been tracking. And I guess what I want to start off with is something that I say a lot of times when I talk to somebody who writes about things you do, and that is that when I was growing up as a kid, I would be somebody who was suspicious of government and, you know, I don't believe what they tell me and I don't support their farm subsidies and all that. But when it came to the local police, I felt like if you don't give 100% unconditional support to the local police, then you're some kind of commie. You know, and I don't think I'm the only one who feels that way, who now feels like I've been burned. Like, I shouldn't have been so stupid and naive. Now, do you think that it over the past 20 years or so, as I've sort of come of age, or even 30 years, is it just that I've gotten wiser, or have things just noticeably gotten worse?
It really is something of a predicament to decide which of those two propositions is true. Are the police more abusive today, or are the abuses simply more visible because of the advent of decentralized information gathering and publicity through YouTube and other social media? I suspect that we're dealing with a little of each of those. And like yourself, Tom, I'm somebody who perhaps two or three decades ago had a rather winsome perspective on the local police. I was somebody who subscribed entirely to the concept of officer friendly, in large measure because as a young man I aspired to become a police detective, and I spent a great deal of time in the company of law enforcement officers, whether you're talking about municipal police or sheriff's deputies, and I actually studied that for a while academically. And one of the things that I've come to conclude is that starting probably in the early 1970s and then accelerating dramatically in the early 1990s, you had a sort of forced draft recomposition of the police culture, the law enforcement culture, where some of the things that were obvious even then, some of the trends that were unfortunate, were amplified dramatically. That would be, of course, the militarization of police tactics and hardware, and more importantly, the militarization of their mindsets. But like yourself, Tom, I'm somebody who considers himself to be somewhat chastened at the memory of some of the attitudes I had about the police decades ago, and I should have been paying more attention. Somebody once said, I can't remember who, that a conservative is a liberal who's been mugged by reality, and you could say that a civil libertarian is a conservative who's discovered that the police are not our friends.
And as I say, I'm kind of embarrassed now when I look on it at how silly I was in the past. And that's not to say that you can't find honorable people in every profession, blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
But the fact is, a government employee is a government employee. You're not supposed to have a, you know, I'm going to salute type of attitude. You have to have a skeptical attitude. Now, what do you think has been driving it? Is there a factor that accounts for it? Is it that they've been little by little seeing what they can get away with, and they've grown to conclude they can get away with an awful lot because no one responds? Is it the drug war that's the driving factor? What accounts for this, do you think?
The drug war, of course, I think is a very important breaking point between what had existed before about 1971 or 72 and what we have now. And this is something that was declared by the Nixon administration for reasons of cynical political opportunism. They wanted a wedge issue generationally. They thought that going after the stereotypical denizens of the drug culture would have multiple benefits, multiple impacts that would be beneficial when you're talking about their Southern strategy and appealing to the so-called silent majority. And so I think that they use that as a way of rebranding their effort in law enforcement-friendly terms, law and order terms that would appeal to blue-collar ethnic Democrats. And as a result, you had the SWAT concept, which had been pioneered back in 1968, in the LAPD, using a concept that had actually been field-tested in Vietnam. That's an important aspect of the story, too, I think. The SWAT concept really took root and flourished, and that would have been about 1971, 72, or 73 or so. And then a generation later, you had an escalation under Bill Clinton, who came from a rather different social cohort than Richard Nixon had in terms of his personal behavior and his personal acquaintance with drugs. But they militarized the war on drugs dramatically during the interim, yet George H.W. Bush, as the vice president, somebody who'd been an employee of the CIA, which is the world's largest drug cartel, as far as I can tell, in the 1980s, presiding over this effort to carve out exceptions to posse comitatus to allow direct military involvement in drug interdiction efforts. That happened in the 1980s. Waco was another important milestone, if you will, because they used the drug nexus by imputing to the Branch Davidians the supposed involvement in methamphetamine. They're actually very much opposed to methamphetamine and other narcotic drugs. But Governor Richards of Texas, taking advantage of one of the posse comitatus exceptions that had been pioneered by the Republican presidential administration in the 1980s, said that there was a drug nexus to the investigation of the Branch Davidians, which allowed her to get Special Forces involvement directly in planning the ATF raid, which she authorized, the federal ATF raid, and the subsequent FBI siege of the Branch Davidians. And a couple of years later, you had Jana Reno, who distinguished herself by immolating the Branch Davidians in April of 1993, creating the LESO program, Law Enforcement Support Organization program, which is used to send surplus war hardware from the Pentagon directly to local law enforcement bodies. So I think that's driving this to a large extent, rather than defining the needs and finding the technology that might be suitable, because all this hardware is available from the Pentagon, yet police chiefs and county sheriffs say because the hardware is available, we'll reconfigure the mission to meet the availability of the hardware. And so they get all kinds of military and war-grade munitions from the Pentagon. They have special forces operators training their SWAT teams, their tactical teams, and suddenly, rather than seeing themselves as peace officers, you have police officers and deputy sheriffs who see themselves as combatants fighting a counterinsurgency war that's a 360-degree battle zone. And that's not a good development.
You know, Will, I had not too long ago Carla Garrick of the Free State Project on the program, and of course you know that the authorities there in Concord, New Hampshire, wanted to get, and apparently did get, an armored vehicle because they need to protect themselves against the terrible Free Staters and all these other domestic threats. But what I want to note is the article that you wrote about a place probably no one on this listening to this program has heard of, the 5,000-person town of Preston, Idaho. And you would think that given that Preston, Idaho is a fairly tranquil place, there's no violent crime there. But I love the way you explain how the police chief says that this is precisely why we need to make sure that we have this sort of militarized force, that you might be deceived into thinking there's no prospect of violence here. You'd be wrong. Can you tell us about this? Because I think that is such a classic illustrative example, what's going on in Preston, of what's going on in many neighborhoods.
I agree with you, of course. Some of your listeners might be acquainted with the film Napoleon Dynamite, which is a whimsical and eccentric film that came out, about 10 or 11 years ago, that depicted this little town in southeastern Idaho, which is where I grew up, not in Preston, but in southeastern Idaho. I grew up in a very similar town to Preston. And as you point out, Tom, there's no measurable violent crime in Preston, Idaho. It's culturally homogenous. It's rural. This is, if any place in the western United States would meet this description, the nearest equivalent to the mythical Mayberry you're likely to find. Sheriff Taylor, of course, did not have an MRAP, which is a mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicle, and he gave one bullet to his deputy, and he was very, very leery about the disposition of that ordnance when he gave it to Deputy Sheriff Fife. Chief Geddes really should not have a police department to begin with. They don't need a police department in a town of 5,000 in southeastern Idaho. It's the county seat of Franklin County, which means that the sheriff's office is right there. But Chief Geddes, like several other police chiefs here in the state of Idaho, found out through this 1033 program, that's part of the LESO program I referred to earlier, found out that these MRAPs were being made available. There are about 2,700 of them. The Department of Homeland Security has now made available for domestic use. So he filed an application, and he got one for, quote-unquote, free, as he put it to me. It's free. Granted, we don't have a whole lot of violent crime here, but you can never tell when we're going to have a Columbine erupt, or perhaps we'll have some kind of a siege involving some restive splinter faction of the Patriot Movement, or some such nonsense might erupt here in Preston. Besides that, he said, being rather prickly and defensive as I asked him these questions, why are the people in Preston less important? You're seeing MRAPs being delivered to police departments in Nampa, Idaho, which is about 80,000 people. Once again, not a very big city, not a very high violent crime rate. And in Boise, they just acquired an MRAP, and that's a town where the violent crime rate has gone down every year since 2000. And it was less than half the national average in violent crime terms to begin with. So why are these people more important than the people in Preston? And I tried to point out to him, well, you're not dealing with a technology here that would be terribly beneficial to the public at large, because this would shield the officers, it would conduce to officer safety, which is the highest priority, apparently, for every law enforcement department in the country. And he was trying to say that by making the officers safer, you're making the public safer. And, of course, there's a disconnect there. There's an undistributed middle of that argument, if you will. It depends upon what the officers are doing, whether or not making them safer will make the public safer. But his rationale was, it's free to the taxpayers here, although that's not true, because they have to maintain the thing. It is a tremendous fuel hog. It gets less than 5 miles to the gallon. You have to train people in maintenance, and you have to invest some money in the upkeep of the vehicle itself. But because it was free, he got one. And the same thing happened with Nampa. The Nampa Police Department got one. And the Boise Police Department recently got one. They're being given away to even smaller county sheriff's offices in rural counties across the country and so forth. And this is, once again, a really good example of how the technology is driving the perceived need. These people were crying out for militarized hardware to deal with a violent crime problem. They're trying to define a problem in order to justify the acquisition.
Now, I'm not trying to be flippant here, but doesn't it seem that according to his reasoning, there really would be no reason for any place in the country, any police department, not to have one of these, right? I mean, Preston gets one, why wouldn't, you know, any old backwater get one? And I don't mean that to insult Preston, but for heaven's sake, right? It's not exactly ground zero, so to speak, of danger in the country, right?
Yeah, if they play in Preston, it should play anyplace else. And so they've really set a marker here that's, I think, alarming, or should be considered alarming. If you have a town of 5,000 with no measurable violent crime rate, they're militarizing the police department there, then I suppose the question is, if it's like that in the Greenwood, what's it like in the dry?
All right, Will, let's shift gears here. Tell us what happened in Deming, New Mexico, not too long ago, with a guy named David Eckert. What happened to this guy, and was he asking for it?
I'm persuaded that David Eckert was singled out for retaliation because he had committed contempt of cop in September of last year. He's become famous in one of the worst imaginable ways. He was subjected to object rape at the orders of the police last January. He was stopped after supposedly rolling through a stop sign as he pulled out of a Walmart parking lot. The police officer who allegedly witnessed this violation did not stop him, but radioed ahead to another police officer who appears to have been lying in wait for Mr. Eckert. He appears to have been under surveillance. And within a few minutes after he had been issued a citation for a moving violation, he was told he was free to go. And then they pulled the infamous Detective Columbo routine. Oh, just one more question we'd like to ask you. And that had happened in September of last year, just a few blocks away from his house. He lives in another town just outside of Deming in a different county. He was stopped just short of his house, and the police officer said, "You've got a cracked windshield. I'm going to write you a warning citation, and you're free to go." And as he turned to go, Eckert said, Eckert was given that Columbo routine once again. "Now, well, just one more question." Eckert said, "You said I was free to go. I have no intention of answering your questions. Goodbye." And the police officer professed to be offended, said that was rude. "So now we're going to search your car. We're going to search your person for narcotics." So we called in a canine dog, and they seized his car and kept it for a day, searched his car, searched his person, saw no evidence, narcotics. That happened last September. In January of this year, the same kind of thing happened, but this time they brought in about a dozen or more police officers from three separate jurisdictions, including two who were part of a federalized multi-jurisdictional narcotics enforcement task force, which is headquartered there in Deming, New Mexico. Now, this is a town of, about 20,000 people, I think, and it's afflicted with an outpost of the Homeland Security Department that's involved in a border narcotics enforcement team run by the Department of Homeland Security. So you have a couple of people who are cross-deputized to this federal task force, one of whom is a canine operator with a canine that isn't certified to conduct drug tests in New Mexico, as it turns out. But they, once again, seized his car and then seized his person. They said that he was not under arrest, but he was handcuffed and put in a police vehicle and not allowed to call anybody, which means you're under arrest. They obtained a warrant from Deputy District Attorney Daugherty there, and they requested permission in the search warrant not only to search the car but to search the person of Mr. Eckert. Why was the search of his person warranted? Because one of the people with this task force said that Mr. Eckert was known in the county where he's from to be somebody who smuggles narcotics in his rectum. Now, this was either a rumor or it was a lie, but in either case, it doesn't constitute probable cause. But it was taken as if it constituted probable cause. So he was taken in Deming to an emergency treatment facility, an emergency room, basically. And the attending physician said, "I'm not going to be any part of this. I'm not going to take part in this because what you're doing is it's illegal, it's unethical, it's unconstitutional, it's immoral, and it's wrong. I'm not going to cooperate." So the police officers called the attorney, and he suggested that they go to another town outside the county where apparently they have a standing relationship with people in the emergency room to do this type of invasive search of a person's body, because they've done this on at least one other occasion. So Mr. Eckert was taken out of the county, meaning the search warrant was invalidated. The search warrant was issued for the hours of 6 o'clock in the morning until 10 o'clock on the evening of the day of his arrest. It wasn't described as an arrest, but it was. And by the time he got there, it was almost 9 o'clock, and he underwent an abdominal x-ray that cleared him. There was nothing to be found, not for a lack of looking, of course, I specify. Not being satisfied with this, the police demanded, and the medical practitioners carried out, several invasive digital probes of his body cavities, and then several forced enemas, and ultimately a colonoscopy, which is an invasive surgical procedure. This all took place after 10 o'clock in the evening, once again outside the county. Assuming that the search warrant was valid, and it wasn't, it was based on rumor, the search warrant was invalidated by the place where they'd taken him and the fact that they had transgressed the limit, the time limit, but they kept him for 14 hours and forced him to undergo all these involuntary probes of his intimate anatomy, which means that this is rape. Many times somebody probes involuntarily and without any kind of legal justification the intimate anatomy of another person, it's a form of object rape. And the crowning indignity is that after he was released from the hospital and he had to endure the mocking and derisive comments of his captors, Mr. Eckert went home and he started to receive bills from the hospital, $6,000 they expect him to pay for the privilege of being subjected to this procedure, which once again is tantamount to sexual violation. Now, Demi, New Mexico is an interesting little town in that, as I pointed out, you've got this node of the Homeland Security State and this Border Enforcement and Narcotics Enforcement Task Force, which about 5 or 6 years ago came under scrutiny by the Department of Homeland Security because the people running the local outpost of the War on Drugs were embezzling taxpayer funds and then allowing so-called controlled buys of heroin that were in no sense controlled. They were double-dipping or triple-dipping from various accounts in order to pay off a protected drug dealer as a supposed confidential informant that would use that informant to build up a statistically impressive number of arrests and so-called controlled operations, but then allow him to bring heroin across the border from Mexico and then simply sell it. And this was simply the price of doing business there in order to help their careers prosper. And the whistleblower who reported what was going on, of course, was fired by the department, or the ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Department within the Homeland Security Department. And there was no punishment meted out to the official miscreants who had been conducting this little scam there in the town of Deming. But that's the task force that employed at least two of the so-called local police officers who were involved in this horrible episode of grotesque sexual abuse of an innocent man. It's the sort of thing, the sort of abuse that is begotten plentifully by the so-called war on drugs. It's actually a fairly common thing, Tom, to see people who are pulled over for routine traffic violations find themselves on the receiving end of this type of treatment by police. There have been several episodes in Texas involving roadside body cavity searches of women after routine traffic stops. And there are several cases I've reported out of the state of Utah in which people have been forced to undergo involuntary catheterization to inspect their blood alcohol content or inspect their bloodstream for evidence of the ingestion of government-prescribed substances. So it really is a fairly routine thing now for the police under the rubric of the war on drugs to be conducting what amounts to government-licensed sexual molestation of innocent people.
Now, let me play devil's advocate here, Will. I mean, not to the extent of defending, anal cavity searches or anything like that, but I'm just trying to imagine what the average person hearing the details of this case would say. And I think the average person would say, well, I agree, this is a despicable, this is a disgusting, and there may have been ulterior reasons behind it that were something other than protecting the public and all that. But still, we are talking about a relative handful of cases. And when somebody like Will Grigg focuses our attention so single-mindedly on these abuse cases, it causes the public to have a general contempt for the police, which is not good for law and order. So how would you answer that sort of Archie Bunker response?
Well, I would plead, I suppose, no contest to the charge that I'm trying to cultivate contempt for the police, because I think that the behavior of the police is in most circumstances contemptible and furthermore contemptuous of the public they supposedly serve. These are anecdotal examples, but they do accumulate to the point where if you've got half a dozen or more instances of this sort spread across the broad geography of the country, you're not talking necessarily about something that would simply be the skimmings off the stagnant pond of corruption in a place like Deming, New Mexico. You have Deming, you have Texas, you have Utah, you have California. And when you see this sort of thing proliferate across the countryside, the question you should ask somebody who offers that criticism would be, how many high-profile episodes of this type of abuse are we going to countenance before it becomes obvious that it is a policy? Granted, when you have this sort of thing publicized, then you're told that there might be specific applications of this that were wrong. But these officers are never held accountable in the sense of facing criminal charges for this type of aggressive abuse of another human being. They're never held accountable in that sense. They might suffer some kind of administrative sanction that usually involves a paid vacation or perhaps a letter of reprimand. But the question I always ask is, under what circumstances is it right for any human being to do this to another human being, irrespective of the way that the perpetrator is attired or whatever title he might claim? It's not a question of how you're dressed. It's not a question of your occupational title. It's a question of what you're doing to another person. And what circumstance is it proper for anybody to pull over another human being by the side of the road and subject him to that type of misbehavior? And too many people, as you probably understand, Tom, have become inured to the notion that there is some special status enjoyed by people in government-issued costumes called uniforms that elevates them above the common run of the rest of the population. And I'm trying to help people confront that assumption here. The promise made by Robert Peel when he created the Metropolitan Police in London back in the early 1800s was that the police would be just like the citizens. He said that the police are the public and the public are the police. And the reason why we're going to have a constabulary here is so that certain people, by way of vocation, will do what all citizens should do in terms of protecting the rights and property of the innocent. But unfortunately, baked into the cake of that proposition was this paramilitary order that has eventually now been revealed as the whole purpose of the exercise. All of the promises that were made in terms of keeping this system under check and making it subordinate to law, all those promises have been dispelled. What remains now is this paramilitary institution of privileged aggressors. And I'm trying to help people understand that that simply is unsuitable for a civilized and free society.
Will, tell people how they can follow your writing and your work.
My chief outlet is my blog, Pro Libertate, which is found at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Freedom in Our Time is one word, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I do a weekly radio program at the libertyroundtable.com website for the Liberty News Radio Network. And the radio program is called Freedom Zella Radio. It comes on every Saturday evening at 8 o'clock Mountain Time. And the website for that is libertyroundtable.com. And there's a listen live now button at the upper left-hand quadrant of that page. And like yourself, Tom, a lot of what I write is republished at lewrockwell.com, which is, I think, an indispensable outlet for people who are interested in individual liberty.
Well, Will, there's so many other things we could talk about. I mean, you've got an item that basically is related to nullification that we could also get to. I mean, there's just so much to talk about. I'll definitely have to have you back on. We'll make sure and put links to those sources in the show notes for this episode. But Will Grigg, you are generous with your time, and you're a heroic reporter in the way people used to be before the age of propaganda descended upon us as it has. So thanks so much for your work and for your time.
Tom, thank you so much. God bless.
All right, everybody, that was Will Grigg, prolibertate.us. and freedominourtime.blogspot.com. He is the man on this stuff. Make sure you're following him. And make sure, too, that you are subscribing to this program. Don't just fetch a fugitive episode here and there. Subscribe to the program. We are on iTunes. We are on Stitcher. We've got an RSS feed at tomwoodsradio.com. So make sure and subscribe. Spread the word. Keep on listening. And we'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.